أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another session, the 17th session of our course from Ali alayhi salam to al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So far in the course we've been discussing a lot of different topics regarding Imama and Mahdawiyah, and we've established many things at an intellectual level using the intellect, using Quran, using ahadith and so on. Now we've come to a point in our discussion where we've established a lot of things, okay? But when we go and look on ground and see how things unfolded themselves in reality on ground by looking into history, we find that we still have a lot of questions, and we see sometimes we feel that there are some things contradicting what we've established within these discussions. Now, in order to answer these questions, we sort of need to go back into history, look at what happened, and then compare that with what we've established. And for this really important discussion, we have with us Sheikh Muhammad Baqir. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikhana.
Alaykum assalam.
Thank you very much again for being with us.
Pleasure, thank you.
So inshallah, in this discussion, this is what we want to do. We want to see how Imamat and Mahdawiyat actually unfolded itself in history, and why are there these contradictions between what we see happen on ground and what we've established at this, in this level of this, what we would call intellectual discussions. Okay, just to get the discussion rolling, let me start by asking this question. Why should we give importance to what happened on ground when we've already established a lot of these things from the Quran and the Hadith? So in reality, what I'm sort of trying to ask is, what role does historical events have in our belief system, or do they even have a role?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Definitely this is a very good question, and it's a key question before we get into this discussion. When we're looking at the role of history, it's very important to understand that as far as our beliefs are concerned, okay, history has a very limited scope. Okay. Now, if we go back and touch upon the sessions that we had in the start of the course with Sheikh Kazim, I believe, okay, we spoke about the proofs that we use, right? The sources of knowledge, the tools of knowledge, yeah, that we have.
The, okay, tools that we're going to use to, okay, to assess.
So when it comes to our beliefs, what are we looking at? We're looking at those things which take us to certainty, right? Okay. Now, so we have the intellect, we have the Quran, we have the ahadith with all the discussion with regards, yeah, to how they've reached us and all, yeah, of that.
Okay. And how these tools help take, yeah, us to certainty.
And, yeah, the idea that we've so far tried to get across is that, look, all these tools together should you know, play hand in hand so we reach that certain knowledge that we want to reach, yeah, right? Now, history, because of the way it is, more often than not, we don't have so strong proof with regards to historic incidents when it comes to minute details, okay,
to understand exactly, yeah, what was happening, so what was in the mind of the person.
As far as our beliefs are concerned, that we have 12 imams, what are the names of the imams, these kind of things, they're very similar in the ahadith and in history, yeah, okay, so there's no discord between the two, there's no conflict between the two, yeah, so there's no concern over here. The concern and the conflict starts when, for example, history comes and tells us that, for example, let's say Imam Hassan alayhi salam would divorce a lot. Mm. Okay. So now what do we have? We have, on one side, we have extremely strong arguments saying that Imam Hassan alayhi salam is the second imam, and he's infallible, he does not commit mistakes, and so on and so forth. And he abides by the Sharia. Mm. Okay. On the other hand, you have a report which says, one report, for example, two reports, okay, three reports, okay, that say that the imam would do something, okay, which is disliked by Allah subhanahu, yeah, wa ta'ala.
In this case, divorcing a lot.
Yes, yeah, in this case, divorcing a lot. And again, the same place where these traditions have been mentioned, for example, one or two traditions, in the same chapters, for example, you'd have traditions saying that divorcing a lot is something abhorred. It's something, yeah, that Allah does not like, right? So now when you have these strong principles, okay, as in these the strong evidence, and you've reached certainty, okay, when you come and see a report, okay, that sort of cannot be put together. You cannot reconcile between
clear
the two.
Contradiction. Yeah, yeah, what we call a head-to-head contradiction.
Yeah, basically. You can't reconcile between the two. Okay, now you have two options. Okay, you take something which is weak, which is feeble. Okay, and you put aside everything that you've established so far. Mm. Okay, and that all that certainty because of this one report, for example, that says that, you know, Imam Hassan alayhi salam was would commit a lot of divorce, for example, would divorce a lot. Okay? Or you come and say that, look, what I have over here is so strong, okay? Something like this cannot destroy it. Yeah. So I'll keep sticking to this. And let's just put this aside because we don't know where it's come from. Mm. We don't know why this has reached us. Mm. The two do not explain each other.
Yeah.
We cannot reconcile. We cannot accept in both of them. Yeah. So what are we getting at? We're basically saying that, look, the tools of knowledge that we have, okay, they all have their own strengths.
Mm.
Okay. Now, when we look at them, we need to identify which is stronger and which is not strong enough. Okay. We can't put these tools at the same level.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in terms of its weight in our understanding of things, for example, if you have a historical report that contradicts, for example, a clear intellectual premise, then we can't give importance to this historical event because the intellect is clearly saying this can't have happened.
Exactly.
So it's something very similar to what Sheikh Imran mentioned when you were talking about Mahdawiya. It was a side point he had mentioned that, you know, when we're trying to establish the belief in the existence of God, there's two ways you can approach it. Sometimes some people look at the problem of evil and then they're like, okay, because evil exists, then God doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Whereas the opposite, the correct way would be when once you've established God exists and you see evil, you try to explain this reality in light of God. So these were in terms of intellectual discussions. So sort of same thing happens between...
coming to this exact same point that now look at history. Let's understand what history is. History, as the teachers would say, his story, right? They break it down to this, his story. It's a story. Right, it tells us how an individual or people lived, how they did their actions, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Right now, when you look at a historic report, for example, okay, a historic report comes and tells you that I picked this thing up, right? Or okay, let's look at a better example. Okay, a historic report comes and tells you that Amirul Mu'minin alayhi salam was injured in war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now with this, it's possible that this reporter, okay. He also said that Amirul Mu'min alayhi salam was injured in war because he was a weak warrior.
Hmm.
Okay. Now this is you were looking at this as a historic report.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we come and start questioning, but didn't we say that the imams have to be brave?
Okay. Yeah.
And then we put aside this whole argument and all the evidence and all the proof that we have.
So we use this historical report to question what we've already established concretely.
Exactly. Whereas there's two issues over here. Okay. Issue number one is that the historic report, the historic fact, really, if it's a true fact, if everything, the source and the individual who said it, if everything is in order, the historic fact really is that Amirul Mu'min alayhi salam was injured in war.
Hmm.
Okay. The second part is his own analysis.
In fact, we know this specifically because we know that the imams are shuja, they're brave.
Yeah. Therefore, but that's exactly the point I'm coming to. Even if we didn't have this, even if you come and tell me, for example, XYZ, even if you tell me Mohd Bakr was injured in war because he's weak, I'd still come and tell you that, look, because is your analysis. And why, and that's the second issue. Why is that? This is because there could be 100 reasons for someone to get injured, right? We know that the Prophet got injured in war. Right? Okay? We know that there can be 100 reasons. For example, someone attacked him from behind. He let someone attack him, for example. There can be so many reasons for getting injured in war. Right? Being weak is not the only reason for getting injured in war. Right? So, based on these two issues that we have with history, okay, history cannot, when it comes to these very tiny issues, okay, or small instances that have happened once in a while, okay, these cannot come and attack and break those things which we have established with certainty with the right tools.
Yeah. So history basically has its own place. So we do, for example, when it came to Ghadir, we did use history, but then that was very clear history, and it was an established fact. And we also said that the Quran is alluding to this fact in history. Okay. So the weight of that historical event went up, and that allowed us to use it to understand the Quran.
Exactly. So here's the question that comes in there. Okay, how exactly do we use history, right? And again, we're looking at history that doesn't take us to certainty, okay? Mm-hmm. History that takes us to certainty and such that it doesn't raise, there's no more questions left, that's fine, we're okay with that, okay? But historic events where, for example, you come and narrate one incident that the Imam did this, the Prophet did this, for example, the Prophet didn't do this, right? These instances or these reports, if at all, they lead to questions like, okay, why did this happen? Why did this not happen? Mm. Did it really happen? Did it not happen?
Yeah. Basically, those are those individual instances that could have many reasons behind them, right?
Yeah. Now, this is where historic analysis comes into play, right? And this is where the value of history shows itself.
Okay? You know, visualize
the history. Yeah, you put in as many details as you can, okay? And then you start connecting dots. And a lot of these dots are exactly what the analysis are. Yeah, these are assumptions. You're assuming that, look, people behave in this way. Hence, this should have happened, for example, right? When you, for example, someone enters the house, we assume that normally people greet each other. They welcome them in. Yeah, you're connecting these dots. These won't be there in a historic report, right? And when something different has been mentioned, then it catches your eye. So, for example, when the reporter says the Imam started speaking before he was questioned, you realize, oh, wait, this is important for me.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. But when that's not mentioned, you can't say that, oh, the Imam asked a question, that means he doesn't have ilm al-ghaib.
So basically, the dots that you're connecting are basically stem from your previous understanding. You have a certain worldview, and that sort of you implementing those things.
And there could be 100 interpretations. Mm. You need to make sure that you get your interpretation right. Yeah. You need to have enough evidence to be able to to reach a conclusion. But if you don't have those tools, and if you can't reach a certain conclusion, then that's it. You mention your historic facts. And you suggest theories. So in this sense, that's why scholars of history, experts of history will tell you that history in a way is like an empirical science, where you're constantly testing out norms and customs and traditions of different people, how people work. You understand how people in communities work, how traditions work. And then based on that, you're proposing theories. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these need to be tested again and again, right? They don't always answer positively, right? And that's where you need to keep that, be cautious
sort of
that
these theories, you test them by seeing if they end up making a complete.
It fits in your worldview.
Yeah, it fits in your worldview.
It fits within all those things that you've already established before, because those are certain, right? Okay. And then obviously there are those things which the evidence that you were looking at, the Quran and the Hadith, would not have spoken about, for example, right? So those are those holes or gaps which the Quran and Hadith does not need to speak about, for example, right? Yeah, so there was the mention of Surah Yusuf, I think, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned those points in the story of Yusuf, Prophet Yusuf, that were important for guidance and for the people, right? Now, there are lots of things that have been left out. Now, if historic reports come and fill those details in, again, as long as they're in line with our belief system, as long as they're in line with the fundamentals that we have, we'll accept them. The moment we see that, okay, this is a bit iffy, you know, like there's a few concerns and questions rising here, instead of backtracking on our beliefs, what we'll say is that, okay, hold on, this is something problematic. We can't accept it so easily unless someone can explain it to us in a way that our belief system is not being affected. And this is exactly what we did in the hadith as well, right?
Yeah.
We said that we look at all the hadith together and then we see where the conflict is. If we can reconcile, we can put them all together, alhamdulillah. If we can't, we keep them aside. If it's clear and certain that this is a lie, it's fabricated, yeah, then we push it aside. We say that this is fabricated, we don't want it. If it's only that I can't explain it, I keep it aside and I wait, maybe someone else can explain it in a better manner. Maybe someone who's an expert at history, an expert at, for example, sociology, an expert at understand at psychology, for example, yeah, will be able to explain this incident much better in a way that it doesn't create conflict with all those things that we already believe in.
Mm.
So this that's why maybe we could conclude saying that history sort of is a lens, or even better, that you already have a lens, but history is like the cloth that you use to clear and clean your lens. It allows you to see more vividly, more clearly, and appreciate what has happened.
Yeah.
And that's where the idea of learning from the past, getting lessons.
So can I put it in these words that the history doesn't define our beliefs. Our beliefs define history. So when we have a historical events, whether we like it or not, where there's facts, we take the facts, obviously with their authentication. when we're connecting the dots, whether we like it or not, our beliefs are defining what those dots are. So if I come and, for example, I analyze the life of Imam Ali, whilst not believing in his imamah, whilst not believing, for example, that imamah was his right, not only his right in normal sense, but it was a duty for him, for us to obey him and for him to take up his right from Allah. If we don't have this belief, then when we see Imam Ali not fighting with the Khulafa, then the conclusion will come with that there's no problem between them. Imam Ali is happy with them. But if I have the belief that this is a right Allah has given him and he has to perform it, and we have to obey him as a leader, when we see that Imam Ali does not fight with the Khulafa, now we would interpret in a different way. That maybe Imam Ali was avoiding something. He was avoiding a chaos, for example, if he was to fight, or things like that. So our belief are sort of defining and explaining history rather than history at least, having an impact.
Yeah, at least it puts that red line and tells us that, look, Mr. History teacher, don't cross this red line.
Mm. Yeah. Don't go beyond the facts.
Yeah. Now start your analysis here. We're happy to learn more. We want to learn more. We want to understand exactly why Amir al-Mu'min did what he did. Yeah. Why did he not fight the caliphs, for example? Yeah. Right? And the history analyst should now come forward and say that, look, I'm putting all the evidence, the historic evidence together. I have one report here, one report here, one report here. All the beliefs that you've told me to stick to. Putting all this data together, these are the different options or suggestions or theories that I have. Now pick whichever works best.
Okay.
If you can put all the...
Whichever theory works best.
Yeah, whichever theory fits most and best, is more appropriate and suitable. Okay, accept that. Whichever does not... bounce it off. I don't want it.
So what does influence our beliefs, or what we can use to strengthen our beliefs, are the facts, right?
Yeah,
so this is where the seerah actually comes into place. Or in fact, when we had mentioned with Sheikh Kadim that the sunnah is not just the words of the Prophet, right? They're the actions of the Prophet. So when we look at the action, this is a fact that, for example, this tells us there's a permissibility. So if we see Imam Ali, for example, not fighting the Khulafa, this fact shows us that there are times when, the least we can say, there are times when we should not confront somebody although our right is taken. This is the least we can say. Now when we put all the other information we have from the Quran, Hadith, intellect, then we can give more meat to this and explain it even more. This is how it works basically, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Just so that it's clear, because sometimes, you know, like when you hear this, you feel like, wait, you're sort of, you know, imposing. Yeah, but this is really how things work in life, right?
It's not imposing because you don't have a choice. These analysis, at the end of the day, your own.
It's like fitri. It's intellectually, it's sound, it's a result of sound reasoning, right?
Yeah.
And this works in day-to-day life, right? With news, for example, right? This is how things work, right? We have the same incident that has taken place, right? And two different news channels would tell us about that incident and describe that incident differently, depending on their worldview. So we might see something as a good incident, and someone else might come and say, no, this is, for example, an unacceptable act, and this is an abhorrent act, or, you know, this is an unforgivable act. And it works the other way around as well, right? We might say that, for example, we should support these people, and someone else might say that we shouldn't support these people, right? So there's constantly this clash of ideologies happening when it comes to specific incidents on ground. And that's what makes analysis of history so difficult. Because you're not just looking at the incident. So first you need to look at the incident. You need to make sure you've gathered all the information available.
All the facts, okay?
Yeah. And then you need to try and understand that, look, what are the ideologies behind? Yeah, what are the ideologies at play when they're coming and analyzing
this? What makes sense, basically? How do I make sense of this event?
Yeah, because, you look at the incident, you look at all the reports, then you'll come and look at, you'll try and differentiate between the facts and the analysis, right? If there's, let's say, multiple analysis, okay? But if you're able to conclude that, look, these people have a different worldview, then again...
Analysis has no value for me.
Yeah, it has no value. Yeah. You'll easily keep it aside. You won't even think twice. Yeah. But now, for example, if majority of your own scholars, those people who have the same worldview, are saying the same concept, then you're like, wait, maybe this is what we believe in, right? Mm-hmm. And no one seems to have an issue with it. So now I need to try and think of alternate theories.
Yeah. Okay, so now that we've understood how history plays a role in terms of our beliefs and how these two work together, it would be nice for us to go into history and maybe take examples of events or of actions that our imams took, stances that our imams took that don't really match with what we believe in, and see how these fit together. Now, being in the discussion of Imam Mahdi and the last session in this section of Imam Mahdi and digging out the facts, can we focus on Imam Mahdi and see how things were happening at that time and understand why these things happened the way they did?
Yeah. inshallah, we'll try and get to Imam Mahdi, inshallah. But let's try and look at maybe one or two of the imams and see. Let's appreciate the rules that we learned and try and apply them to some of the imams. Understand really what's happening out there. What was happening in the period from after the death of the Prophet until Imam Mahdi. And then we'll come to Imam Mahdi as well, inshallah. And then
get will give us a context of what's happening in Imam Mahdi's time?
Inshallah. We hope so, at least.
Okay.
So, like you mentioned, and I guess as Shias, we've always had this question, right? That what really happened out there that, after Ghadir, after everything that had been said, what really happened out there that Amir al-Mu'mineen did not stand for his right, did not claim his right? Or, for example, what happened, what transpired that resulted in, Sayyida Zahra and the calamity that befell her? Yeah. So these are probably like questions that are, we always have, and it's a burning question. It always every Fatimiyah that comes by, we always have this question that, like, couldn't history have been a bit different? Yeah, like what would have happened?
Why didn't Imam Ali pull the sword? Why did he let Sayyida Zahra just, happen what happened, basically? He is known to be the warrior, the courageous person.
Okay. So something that we should keep in mind is that, look, we're working with people over here, okay? We're working with societies, okay? We're working with hundreds of people, okay? And people are complex individuals, like people are complex existences, yeah? We all don't think in the same way, right? This point in itself is so important to understand, or to, appreciate the fact that there are hundreds of reasons for why people do the same thing that they do. And it becomes really difficult to understand history and these small things that happen in history with this absolutely perfect lens. Basically understand exactly why every individual did what he did.
I guess because the why somebody does something is within his own understanding. We can't, right? Know, the reports don't say what's inside the mind. They just describe what's going on outside.
And that's where it gets important to dig out as many contextual evidences, try and understand what the situation was like, what the people were like, generally speaking. Mm. Yeah. And then try and come to a theory, basically. Okay. So now, one important point here when it comes to the whole situation after the demise of the Holy Prophet is one interesting concept, and I'll just mention it because it is really interesting, and it tries and explains the dynamics of how things work. Like, it's important that while we're looking at things on ground, we shouldn't forget and ignore the presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay? There's this divine hand which is at work at all times. Right? We've already spoken about wa ma ramayt idh ramayt and verses of those type, right? Where there is that divine hand, whether we see it or not, whether we appreciate it or not. Yeah. When we're looking at the incident or the situation after the demise of the Prophet, okay, there's this community, okay, the people of the Prophet, they've been with the Prophet for at least 11 years, right? Well, although 23 years really, but the people of Medina, okay, who are facing the tribulation of this caliphate, okay, the discord of caliphate, they've been with the people with the Prophet for 11 years now, okay? So they have learned a lot, okay? And obviously they've been tested at different times. But now as a community, they're facing this one massive test. And this test is in وَالْبَابُ الْمُبْتَلَى بِهِ النَّاسِ, in the Amr of Wilaya, in the decree or in the order of the belief that they have with regards to the Ahlul Bayt. Amir al-Mu'min, interestingly, when he's finished burying the Prophet, okay, and he's fixing his grave, okay, then an individual, his companion, comes and tells him of what's happened at Saqifa. One of the first things Amir al-Mu'minin recites is أَحَسِبَ النَّاسُ أَن يُتْرَكُوا أَن يَقُولُوا أَمَنَّا وَهُمْ لَا يُفْتَنُونَ. Do people think that they will believe and that's it? They will not be tested?
That they will say they believe, but
that
they will
say that they believe and they will not be tested? Right? So, this concept is a recurring theme again. Okay? And people are going to be tested. And this is one of the tests that the people had. Now again, when you look at history, the Prophet himself has been aware that these people are finding it difficult to accept the Ahlul Bayt, right? And how do I say that? Again, you look at the instances where the Prophet has repeated the message again and again. Sometimes when it comes to you know, discussing with the Ahlul Sunnah, we're stuck on one verse or two verse or one hadith or two, you know, the hadith of Manzila and you know, the, I don't know, the hadith of the 12 Imams. We again, this is where history helps us see better. That look, when you go back in these 11 years or even before that, right from the start, right from the first... Right from there until the demise of the Prophet, the Prophet is constantly repeating this idea that, look, after me, there is Amir al-Mu'mineen who's the Wasi and the Wali, right? So it's recurring again and again and again. Why? Besides the fact that it's an important message that فَمَا بَلَّغْتَ رِسَالَتَ, right? That if the Prophet does not deliver it, it's as though he has not delivered anything, okay? But in this context, it's important to understand that the Prophet himself, with this foresight that he has, with all the understanding that he has of the people, okay, he knows that these people are not going to accept this. Yeah, they're going to challenge Amir al-Mu'mineen. Yeah, and now as it gets closer to the demise of the Prophet, this is becoming stronger and stronger. So Ghadir happens, for example, Ghadir onwards, at least we know that the Holy Prophet would go to the door of Sayyidah Zahra and would keep reciting Assalamu alaikum ya ahla bayt al-Nubuwa. He's constantly repeating and reminding the people, right? Again, very close to his deathbed, the incident of the calamity of the Black Thursday happens. He wants to write it down and put it on pen and paper. He wants to put the idea of the caliphate of Amir al-Mu'mineen on pen and paper. And the caliphs and the companions do not allow him to do so, right? Again, he wanted this shift to happen really quickly. So the whole idea of forming an army under Usama bin Zayd happens, right? Why Usama? Who is Usama? What's so special about him? At least one two important things about him. One, he's young. He's not at the age of the Shaykhan, okay? And two, he's a hafiz of the Quran. The idea that, look, superiority, one of the aspects that brings superiority for an individual, at least in this Islamic system, is ilm, and ilm of the Quran.
I guess the young part is because this idea that they have that the leader should be older.
Exactly. Right? This is one of the arguments, at least, that they use. Whether they really believed in this or no is a different question altogether. But they use this argument against Amir al-Mu'mineen that you're young, you can't become a caliph, right? The Prophet, again, he's forcing. Now, you can, you know, you can either record history saying that the Prophet has ilm al-ghayb, or you can record it as though that the Prophet did these carried out these acts. But what's important is that the Prophet can see this is coming, right?
I mean, you don't even need to have ilm al-ghayb to predict this is coming.
Exactly, right? So now this is coming, okay, and the Prophet can tell. So he's preparing the people, right? But unfortunately, the way things happened in history, we know what happened, and we know Saqifah occurred. We know that Amir al-Mu'mineen was kept out of his right. And in one word, people failed the test. And again, this idea of test is important because in some of our traditions, and even some of our strong traditions in Al-Kafi, we have a strong tradition where Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that after this whole incident, Imam Mu'min alayhi salam was left with only three individuals, and all the Muhajir and Ansar had deserted him. Right? So, Imam Bakr alayhi salam, and he says, ارتد الناس إلا ثلاثة سلمان أبو ذر مقداد. So the people abandoned Amir al-Mu'mineen and Sayyidah Zahra, right? And they failed the test. And then in another tradition, the companion asks, what about Ammar? And the Imam says, Rahimallahu Ammar, may Allah bless him. He was a companion, he became shaheed. Yeah, and then in Siffin he became shaheed, right? And then the companion says, like, no, like, you didn't mention him. So Imam says, no, even Ammar, for a moment he slipped, but then he came back. Yeah,
tough the test was.
Yeah, this was a massive test. People, now, like, you know, what made it difficult for people? You know, again, there's so many reasons that we can underline in history. Also, on a passing note, all that we've said right now, yeah, Dua Nutba really summarizes all of this beautifully, right? If you look at Dua Nutba with the meaning and you understand what's really happening, right from the start, it speaks about all these principles that we've established in the last few days, okay, about the notion of this Khalifatullah becoming the representative of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth, Allah helping Allah giving constant support to his awliya and awsiya. And then when it reaches the Prophet, and then it starts speaking about Amir al-Mu'mineen, and how the Prophet showed it and made it clear to the people that, look, it's Ahlul Bayt, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's his wali, he's his wasi. So all of these historic, ideas can be clearly seen in Du'a Nutba really beautifully. Again, in Du'a Nutba, we have instances where some of these reasons have been mentioned. One of the reasons as to why the people found it difficult to accept Amir al-Mu'mineen was, for example, clearly the idea that this familial ties and this tribalhood, okay, was really strong in the Arabs even until that point. And it's a reality that's existed throughout.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
The idea that there's tribes, and then these tribes, the families in tribes have their relations, and it was an important thing for the Arabs. Yeah. A lot of people, at least the Muhajirin, okay, they had enmity with Amir al-Mu'mineen because Amir al-Mu'mineen had slain their tribal members in all the different battles, right?
Okay, so even though they were not Muslims.
So I'm a Muslim, but my cousin, my grandson, my grandfather, my nephew, my niece, someone was in Badr and Uhud and all these battles, and Amir al-Mu'mineen has fought them. So, I mean, I can't accept someone who's fought my family, for example. Yeah?
And also, we know that there's a decent number of people who accepted Islam, not necessarily because they strongly believed in, right? The Fatah Makkah happened, and a lot of people, they still kept those grudges, that Iman hadn't seeped in their hearts, that they were Muslims in the apparent.
Then we know some of the leaders of the other party, there was jealousy in their hearts, right? Again, very, very beautifully. Again, we haven't, unfortunately, grown up with these texts in Khutbah Fadakiyah, a stronger text than this. Khutbah Fadakiyah. So this Zahra beautifully draws out the whole incident. She talks about the position of Amir al-Mu'mineen, okay, and then she speaks about what these individuals did out of their hatred and their animosity and falling for the trap, right? Some people, like you mentioned, their belief wasn't strong. When Amir al-Mu'mineen said this, I actually went to them to claim the right. What they said was, again, we've already paid allegiance, yeah. So you should have come to us first. Again, this idea that, look, I don't care about what the facts and figures say. It's my customs. This is more important to me than my faith. Okay, this comes first. Yeah, I've already pledged allegiance. This allegiance in the tribal system means a lot. Yeah. So sorry, some other day, next time.
So what does now all of this mean in terms of Imam Ali not fighting for his right? Okay.
In one line, if people are not ready, you can't force down guidance. You can't force guidance down them, right? These people, Medina and all the other, no one really revolted. There were a few people here and there who maybe stood up for Amir al-Mu'mineen, but otherwise, people accepted what the
Let's put guidance aside. Imam Ali, why did he not rise to save his wife?
Okay.
Forget religion. We're talking about a person defending yourself and your family.
Okay. So now there's lots of ways we can answer, right? There's one time we can say that, for example, we have lots of traditions where Imam Ali himself would say that the Prophet had told him, don't stand up for your right. If this happens to transpire, don't stand up for your right. Okay. This is one incident. Or Amir al-Mu'mineen and the Prophet, Amir al-Mu'mineen promised the Prophet that he would not come out of the house and he would not claim his right until he had finished. He would stay in his house and finish compiling the Quran, for example. So there are some of these responses that we have. But if we want to try and analyze what really happened, it comes down to a point that, look, these individuals, they've got all the money, they've gathered support, okay? They've already pledged allegiance. People have pledged allegiance to them. They've taken allegiance from people, okay? And the people are so loyal to this concept of allegiance, okay? That they'll stand by this individual just because they've sworn oath to them, right? Okay? And there's a handful of family, 3 people, 10 people, okay? At the dawn of Islam, 11 years into Islam and the nation of Islam being formed, okay, and Amir al-Mu'mineen has this option that, look, let me rise and fight for my right. Okay, and what happens? I'm going to either kill all of them, which we know. Like, if you're not using miracles, I mean, it's a far-fetched concept, right? We don't work like that, right? Yeah. So what's going to happen is that, okay, even if half the community starts, agrees with me, I am rising against the system. I'm teaching people that it's okay. You can fight the caliphate, okay? And then we're going to have discord in the Islamic Ummah, day one, created by Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam.
But isn't it wajib for him at a personal level to defend his wife? Like, so people are attacking his house, he should be the one going there and fighting. He's Asadullah. He goes in and fights the people who are attacking him.
And then exactly, like, where does it stop? Again, these questions have been answered by the Ahlul Bayt themselves, okay? Very interestingly, Sheikh Mufid narrates this. He says, from Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam, that had it not been for the fear of the Muslim community being destroyed, and as a result, Islam being destroyed, I would have fought them, and I would have fought them in a way that I would have changed what happened, basically. Okay. So in other words, Amir al-Mu'min was left with two options. Okay, either save Islam or save his wife. Okay, or either save Islam, even though someone who's inappropriate for the position leads it. Okay, or rise, make it clear that I don't agree with you, okay, because it's his right, okay, and even though it's his right, it's his responsibility. But then what happens? He gets killed, and Islam still stays in the hands of those individuals.
And we talk about destruction, yeah, basically, of Islam.
Not to forget, this is one of the responsibilities of the Imam, right? So now if the Imam is put in a situation where he's like, look, you have 10 responsibilities that you need to carry out in the community, okay? There's one of them that you're not being able to do right now. Okay,
which is taking the government.
You can't take the governance into your hands. Okay, and as a result, you might not be able to do 5 of the responsibilities. But there's 5 others still left. If you die, if you're killed, those are going to be left as well. And how do you put it? Like, as though the universe will be left without an imam. Imam Hassan, again, is not in a position right now. People, if they're not accepting Amir al-Mu'min as the imam, Imam Hassan obviously is not going to be accepted as an imam. He's a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. Right? So putting all these together, basically, the Imam is left with 2 responsibilities. One is more important, one is important, but when you bounce it off this one is more important.
So basically, the Imam has to make a decision between 2 responsibilities, 2 wajibat, sort of, right? And he, because of his own understanding, takes one side over the other and decides to save Islam and to not fight, because the potential harm this will cause is much bigger than this one. So in order to save Islam, he had to step back, which itself is a form of courage, right? I mean, to keep your sword.
In fact, these are the trials and tribulations that the imams have to face. Yeah. That sometimes they can't carry out some of the something that was their primary responsibility, yeah, because of a more important secondary responsibility.
Yeah. But which we also said that the one of the main responsibilities of the imam is to protect the deen. If to protect the deen means this that I stand back and do not take the government at an official level, but I do my other 4 responsibilities of teaching, of defending, of being the hujja, and of doing tarbiyah of the people, then I need to step back from it. But this is a decision the imam has to take, right? This is not a decision we say, oh, imam, you should have done this or you should have done that.
Yeah. He's in a position to decide at that point, which is the more important responsibility. Yeah. Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam, again, he says in Khutbah Shakshakiyah that I found that endurance was wiser, so I adopted patience although there was pricking in the eye and suffocation in the throat. فَرَأَيْتُ أَنَّ الصَّبْرَ عَلَى هَاتَ أَحْجَى فَصَبَرْتُ وَفِي الْعَيْنِ قَذَى وَفِي الْحَلْقِ شَجَى. So it was such a difficult test for him. His wife, in fact, in one of the traditions, he was asked, one of the imams was asked, right? That was the most difficult thing for a man to bear, and the imam says that to see his wife being beaten or tortured in front of him and him not being able to do anything, let alone if your wife is the is the daughter of the Prophet, right? She's a part of the Prophet. So Amir al-Mu'min is seeing all of this, but defending her is at the risk of letting Islam being destroyed.
And this responsibility is a much greater responsibility. I mean, this is where the courage of the imam shows itself, where the wisdom of the imam shows itself, where they have to make very bitter decisions that way. If we were there, we would have let our anger spill out and, you know, go crazy, defend ourselves, our wife, our children, get killed in there, not thinking that, okay, what are the repercussions of my death? So this is really important. Asantum. So before we continue the discussion, let's take a short break and then we'll continue, inshallah. So brothers and sisters, we'll be back in a moment.
Oh. وأودعته علم ما كان وما يكون إلى انقضاء خلقك، ثم نصرته بالرعب وحففته بجبرائيل وميكائيل والمسومين من ملائكتك، ووعدته أن تظهر دينه على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون، وذلك بعد أن بوأته مضوى صدق من أهله، وجعلت له وله أول بيت وضع للناس للذي ببكة مباركا وهدى للعالمين، فيه آيات بينات مقام إبراهيم، ومن دخله كان آمنا، وقلت إنما يريد الله ليذهب عنكم الرجس أهل البيت ويطهركم تطهيرا، ثم جعلت أجر محمد صلواتك عليه وآله مودتهم في كتابك، فقلت قل لا أسألكم علي أجرا إلا المودة في القربى، وقلت ما سألتكم من أجر فهو لكم، وقلت ما أسألكم عليه من أجر إلا من شاء أن يتخذ إلى ربه سبيلا، فكانوا هم السبيل إليك والمسلك إلى رضوانك. فلما انقضت أيامه أقام وليه علي بن أبي طالب صلواتك عليهما وآلهما هاديا، إذ كان هو المنذر ولكل قوم هاد، فقال والملأ أمامه من كنت مولاه، فعلي مولاه، اللهم والي من والاه، وعاد من عادى، وانصر من نصرى، واخذل من خذل. وقال من كنت أنا نبيا، فعلي أمير. وقال أنا وعلي من شجرة واحدة، وسائر الناس من شجر شتى، وأحله محل هارون من موسى، فقال له أنت مني بمنزلة هارون من موسى، إلا أنه لا نبي بعدي، وزوجه ابنته سيدة نساء العالمين، وأحل له من مسجده ما حل له، وسد الأبواب إلا بابا، ثم أودعه علمه وحكمته، فقال أنا مدينة العلم وعلي بابها، فمن أراد المدينة والحكمة فليأتها من بابها. ثم قال أنت أخي ووصي ووارثي، لحمك من لحمي ودمك من دمي وسلمك سلمي وحربك حربي، والإيمان خالط لحمك ودمك كما خالط لحمي ودمي، وأنت غدا على الحوض خليفتي، وأنت تقضي ديني وتنجز عداتي، وشيعتك على منابر من نور مبيضة وجوههم حولي في الجنة وهم جيراني.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome back to the session. We were discussing with Sheikh Baqir about how we can look at history in lens of our beliefs and how we can explain some of the events that unfolded themselves in history with regards to our imams, obviously. And when we see these apparent contradictions between the actions that that we see from our imams or certain decisions they made, how these go hand in hand with the beliefs that we've already established. So one of the things we mentioned before the break was that, for example, we've established very clearly that the imam is a person who is brave, right? But when we come in history, or for example, that the right of khalifat is for the imam. But when we come into history, we see that Imam Ali actually did not take that position in the start. He didn't even fight for that position. And this is the khilafat aspect. And when it came to defending his wife, he didn't take a stance to defend his wife. Was he scared? So when we look at it from a very non-Islamic and from a perspective where we don't have these premises we've established, we could easily say that, okay, maybe Imam Ali did not believe the khalifat is his right. And he accepted, for example, the first khalif to take it, and that's it.
In fact, there are some Western writers who have even gone to the extent of saying that Amir al-Mu'min did not end up getting the caliphate, although the Prophet himself personally might have preferred him, mm-hmm. because from historic incidents we see that he was of weak character. He could not stand and defend his wife, and the other companions had a stronger character and a stronger personality, which is why they ended up.
They stood for him and he couldn't. Wow. Okay, so this really shows how your understanding reflects itself in history and how we analyze history. So like we said in the beginning of the session, we don't use history or the empty gaps in history to explain our beliefs. Rather, we use our beliefs to explain those gaps in history. We use the facts, obviously. The facts are very good information, but we need to know the place of each of these. So we talked about Imam Ali. Should we move on to another imam and see how we can apply this understanding on another imam?
let's speak a bit more about Amir al-Mu'min.
Okay.
Just building on what we've said so far, when it comes to analyzing history, apart from the principles that we already have, we have one more tool which is really helpful, and that's our fiqh itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now what do I mean? Fiqh gives us our responsibilities, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It tells us what our responsibility on the ground is.
Yeah. So okay. The do's and don'ts, basically. Yeah. That.
Okay,
yeah.
And fiqh works at two levels. Sometimes it tells us what the primary responsibility is, and then it tells us that, look, if you're facing this situation, let go of the primary responsibility, I'll give you another responsibility. So just to give you a few examples, okay, very quickly, the primary responsibility is to obtain tahara through wudu, right?
Yeah.
But if you don't have water available, the fiqh tells you that, okay, you know, you can do tayammum instead.
Yeah.
This is one responsibility. Okay, now there's other such instances as well. For example, entering someone's house without permission is haram, right? So primary responsibility, it's haram to enter someone's house without permission. Secondary responsibility, if someone is dying in that house, and if you have to either let a person die where you could have saved him, or enter without permission, okay, and do a haram, okay, then you're facing a wajib and a haram, okay? And this wajib is more important. Again, who is telling us that? The religion itself is telling us, okay? We don't use
this
that.
This is from our study of the religion that we understand these
things. So these are laws of the fiqh itself, okay? So now between these two responsibilities, the religion comes and tells you that, look, generally speaking, this responsibility is more important, okay? When you're facing with both of them, you put these together and you realize, okay, religion wants me, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told me in his fiqh that I need to prefer this responsibility over the other. So I'll end up doing something that was haram to do responsibilities which is more important at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. But then this doesn't count as haram anymore.
It's not a sin.
It's not haram anymore. Yeah.
In that secondary regard, it's not a haram anymore. In fact, you need to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now this concept Okay, at least for a faqih or for a jurist, when you analyze history with this understanding of deen, with such a comprehensive understanding of religion, it becomes very simple for you to now analyze history, because throughout what's going to happen, okay, with regards to the imams, is that look, the imams are facing different circumstances, yeah, and in all these different circumstances, the imam has to pick the more important responsibility, okay? The more important responsibility in terms of that which Allah wants him to do, okay? With regards to which has the most maximum benefits, basically, okay? Or the most important task that needs to be done in order to defend Islam, in order to look after the religion, look after the people, and all these different criteria that the imam needs to take into consideration. Okay.
Like we said earlier, that who decides which one is more important, the imam has that knowledge.
Yeah, it comes from the religion itself.
An imam has the knowledge of religion to know which one is more important. So in our eyes, we might have said, oh, but imam, maybe you should, like it happened for Imam Hussein, right? Where he said, I'm going to go and rise. And some of the people said, imam,
interesting is, why am I bringing this fiqh aspect to it, is that fiqh tells us it speaks about our actions, right? It tells us the do's and don'ts given in circumstances, right? Yeah. The point is that throughout the lives of the imams, this is what we'll constantly keep seeing, that the imam is between multiple circumstances, and the imam has to pick one or pick a few that he can manage at that point and let go of certain circumstances or certain responsibilities, okay? This becomes a question for us. That why did Imam let go of this responsibility? Okay, and that's when we come back and when we look at the bigger picture, we realize, look, there were 10 responsibilities in the primary level. Okay, the most important responsibility, okay, are those initial things that we've mentioned about the Imam, that he is the representative of Allah Subhanahu wa Taala on earth. He is the one who does tabeen and explains the religion. He looks after and protects the religion. Okay, he is training the Shias as well. He's training his followers towards perfection as well. Okay? These are those primary goals. And the Imam will not let go of any of these goals. Okay? Now, when it comes to the application, it's possible at one point, okay, in order to train the Shias, he'll tell them that, look, I'm doing a peace treaty with Muawiyah. I want you guys to follow me. They don't even understand sometimes. They might even come and insult the Imam. Okay? And it'll become a question for us that, wait, there were people who wanted to fight. The Imam should have fought. Why did he not fight? Mm. Okay?
This is where we bounce it off our belief. We've already established Imam has knowledge. Imam has taqwa. Imam has isma. So if he has made this decision, whether we understand why he made this decision or we don't understand it, what we do know is that it's the correct decision.
It's the correct decision. And it's not that he's letting go of a responsibility. In a normal day, that was his responsibility, yes. If he had the best of companions, if he could have fought Muawiyah, for example, then he should have carried on fighting.
If the circumstances would allow him to.
Now, his primary responsibility has changed. Yeah. So it's like he needs to enter without permission to save a person from dying. So right now, in order to save Islam, instead of fighting, he should backtrack. Yeah. He should.
And I guess our role as people who, for example, are curious about history is to go and dig into why would Imam have taken such a decision, right?
Yeah.
And just to understand, but not to impose a decision on Imam Hassan that, okay, Imam Hassan should have continued. Our analysis of history tells us that Imam Hassan should have continued. We don't know what's going on in Imam Hassan's mind. What we do know is that he doesn't make a mistake, which sort of also explains that, okay, when Imam Hussein rose to fight, why he made that decision when Imam Hassan made an opposite decision. This is their understanding of the situation, their understanding of their responsibility at that time based on the immaculate knowledge that they have of the
deen. And then our role is now to understand these circumstances. And then in our day-to-day life, try and see which circumstance is more similar to that circumstance, right? Then if our circumstances, for example, at any point similar to the time of Imam Hassan, then we know, okay, this is how the Imam would have responded.
But this is not everybody's job to do this, right? Because you have to understand the deen properly. So this is the role of an expert.
That's why I brought in the idea of fiqh, that it requires a jurist to be able to come and understand exactly what Islam wants from you at that point.
Yeah. So it's not only, it's what we call a scholar who has an understanding of social affairs as well. Because this is literally fiqh unfolding itself in society and in the actual outer world. So this requires that extra knowledge of having this basira, which we discussed. So when talking about basira, We have a course on the OLP talking about this whole concept of insight and basira and understanding socio-political matters. And this is unfortunately a very forgotten topic, right? The fiqh is important, the aqaid is important, the akhlaq is important, but we forget that a big part of deen is to actually understand how to actually bring these about in the real world and how to analyze these things. So this concept of basira is really important. We have a course, I think it's called Insight in a World in an Era of Perplexities. I think that's what the course is called. Very interesting course by Sheikh Kadhim. So something definitely the brothers and sisters should pursue if they're interested in this topic. Yeah.
Okay. So now carrying on with Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Okay. Very quickly, again, just to get into the perspective of how things were. Yeah. And everything that followed on, it's a build up of Saqifah and what's really happening. Right. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, when the real opportunity for caliphate comes up, that's after the death of Uthman, okay? What is he dealing with? Okay. Sometimes again, without research, without understanding the situation, the circumstances, we might feel that it was so awesome, like people have shown up finally after what 30, 40 mm-hmm. years, they've come to Amir al-Mu'mineen, they want him, they've realized that they've made a mistake and they want him. Right, but when you go and look at what the evidence suggests, what the reports say, what Amir al-Mu'mineen himself is saying, you realize that it was definitely not the case, right? So Amir al-Mu'mineen, right at that point where people have reached him and they want to appoint him or they want to accept him as caliph, what's the first thing he does? Instead of stretching forth his hand and saying, you know what, okay, there you go, I've been waiting for this all my life. Yeah, Imam says, Sermon number 92 of Nahjul Balagha, leave me and seek someone else, for we are facing a matter which has several faces and colors, which neither hearts can stand nor intelligence can accept. So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam is seeing that, look, imagine what happened in Saqifah. Okay, 30 years have, or 20 years have passed, 25 years have passed, right? Things have just gotten worse, right? And we're in such a circumstance. Now, if I come, I'm going to rule like the Prophet. And my religion is way different to what you're used to now. 25 years, that's like one entire generation, right? Okay? And this is where Amir al-Mu'mineen is like, look, it's my right, it's my responsibility, and I want to do it. I want to accept this. But you're not ready for it.
And what you're asking for me right now is not that reality.
You want a ruler or a governor or a caliph who sticks to what you've gotten used to now. Yes, okay, with regards to the third caliph, it got too difficult, which is why you murdered him. But, you've forgotten that real,
So you're not electing me or accepting me because of that real position that I have. You're accepting me because you've tested different people,
amongst the caliphs, again, I'm the senior most. Yeah. You've come to me, you're like, okay, now all of a sudden you're remembering that Ali, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, had knowledge and he was special prophet, in the eyes of the Prophet. But that's it. And Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying that, look, that's not enough. Hmm. Yeah, I know you will not support me.
It reminds me of, again, we've brought him up so many times, like, this. It's such an amazing story on Imam Basri all over again, where he comes to Imam Sadiq. Imam Sadiq pushes him away. Not because Imam Sadiq doesn't want to guide him. Definitely, obviously, that's his wajib to guide him. But he sort of, in Imam Sadiq's case, by pushing him away and saying that you're not ready for me, it sparks that. I guess Imam Ali as well, when he pushes the people and says, look, go look for someone else, not because he's shying away from his responsibility, or for example, to try and show that, oh, Khilafat is not my right. But there's something behind that he's trying, a message he's trying to give, or maybe saying that, okay, this is not your, it's not the time yet for it.
Yeah. And when you go further then, when you carry on, and then after Amir al-Mu'mineen became the caliph, you see that what really happened. Like, Amir al-Mu'mineen could foresee all of this, right? So he knows what's happened in Damascus. Okay, he knows that it's not really a Muslim empire anymore. It's like a Roman empire over there. Yeah, these people have a completely different version of religion, right? Amir al-Mu'mineen knows that the moment I step in, these people are going to create fitna. Right, and these same people right now who are saying that they want me as caliph, they're going to backtrack. They're not going to support me, right? So Amir al-Mu'mineen sees all these challenges coming. Yeah, so he's warning them that, look. So he says, clouds are hovering over the sky and faces are not discernible. You should know that if I respond to you, I would lead you as you know and would not care about whatever one may say or abuse. Amir al-Mu'mineen can see all of these problems like on the brink of happening, right?
Yeah.
And he's warning the people that, look, are you really honestly ready to accept me? And the people, when they said that, yes, we definitely want you, we don't want anyone else, it came to a point where they said, if we don't accept a caliphate, then we're going to kill you as well, right? And they injured Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein and all those incidents that happened. Then it was like Itmam al-Hujjah. He had to accept that. Okay, everyone is now unanimously saying that I should accept the responsibility. It is my responsibility. I'll accept it.
Yeah.
Because there's this promise from the people that they're going to carry out their responsibility. I mean, yes, it's my responsibility to lead the people, but they have a responsibility to support the system, right? I mean, if they're not going to support the system, who's going to, like, well, who am I leading, really?
And this really also shows us that when we say that, for example, the Shias of Ali in the starting period were not the what we call the Shias, right? All these people who ended up later killing Imam Hussein, going back and becoming Khawarij, some of them like betraying Imam Hassan, those were not although they're called Shias in history, but their reality was not that Shia that we're talking about.
Not all of them. Yes, there were people.
Yeah, there were a few amongst them. Yeah, but this is not. Those are people who are following these personalities from a political perspective. From a you are leaders, not from that really the ideological and worldview that we're talking about here.
So when we look at all these incidents, we're inshallah able to understand the difficulties that Amir al-Mu'min was dealing with. You have the entire sunnah of the Prophet which has changed, okay, and then you have internal issues in the city, and then he has these fitna being created by the three groups, right? And amongst them, the most important and the most severe being that of the Khawarij. Okay, and Amir al-Mu'min, he sort of boasts about the fact that he put out the eye of revolt. He calls the Khawarij the Ainul Fitna. Okay, and then he says that I was the one who destroyed it. Right, now this is again something very important, that this group comes into existence with their own messed up understanding of deen, okay, and they're saying out verses of the Quran, they're worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they're speaking about they might even be speaking about ubudiyah and responsibilities and the wajib and the haram.
In the apparent very religious, very pious
people. They'll be speaking about tawheed, for example, all the time, and then inil hukma illa lillah, for example, okay, that the hukm and the authority only belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like we don't want to ascribe anyone to him. And then when it comes to social issues, when it comes to understanding the dynamics of how religion plays itself, or the different aspects of religion, they don't know anything. They don't understand what religion is.
So basically, these religious teachings are not in a proper perspective in their minds. They've literally taken a literalistic understanding of some of the verses of the Quran.
The challenge for Amir al-Mu'minin is to identify that, as in, he is the one who identified that, look, although these people, they're pretending, or even in their own understanding, they feel that they're the most subservient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they are a fitna that needs to be wiped off the face of earth, right? And he says that if it wasn't for me, no one had the courage to do this. Who has the courage or the understanding or the knowledge or the foresight to say that, look, if these people continue on today, forget Muawiyah, at least Muawiyah, for example, we can tell that he's not following the Quran, right? The people are not following the Quran. These people, in the name of Quran, they're doing this amazing ijtihad, such that Ibn Abbas also is not a match for them. Amir al-Mu'min tells him that you don't go and speak to them, I'll go and speak to them, right? Because Ibn Abbas is also not a match for them at one point. Yeah. So these guys are in their own messed up understanding of the Quran and the Sunnah, right? They're doing their own ijtihad, and they pretend to be jurists. They abuse Amir al-Mu'minin. They would come and insult him. They would abuse the companions of Amir al-Mu'minin, right? And they've brought out a completely new face of Islam. And Amir al-Mu'minin is facing this threat. In the start, he tries to avoid bloodshed. He tries to avoid war, right? And at one point, he's like, no, you know what? This is a fitna, and I need to get rid of them. And no one else, if it's not me today, no one else is going to manage.
So again, this is another example of history where we see this man, Ali ibn Abi Talib, fighting apparently religious people. And if you just look at the history just like that, without having any understanding, you can bring in
the prohibition of fighting your Muslim brothers.
Exactly, yeah. And instead, okay, this person, how can he be ma'asum if he's going and shedding the blood of other Muslims, right? This is incorrect. But if we analyze his history with our understanding that the Imam was ma'soom, his decisions are based on his pure understanding of the deen, then we know that this decision was the right decision to make. Now again, once again, as people who are curious to know what's happening behind the scenes, we go and find out, okay, why would Imam Ali have made such a decision? And then we go in and unravel the fact that the Khawarij, for example, their understanding was very superficial, detrimental to Islam, and therefore Imam Ali had to take such a stance.
It stopped from abuse and just misrepresenting and misinterpreting Islam. It came to a point where they started even committing bloodshed.
Yeah.
Right. They started attacking the companion and attacking any Muslim for that matter who didn't abide by their norms.
That's bound to happen. If anybody takes the Quran in its purely literal sense, you're going to end up doing things like that.
If we move forward now.
Okay. So should we move on to the next Imam?
Ideally, we should speak about as many of the Imams as we could, but again, the time wouldn't allow. And we've heard so much about Imam Hassan alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Very quickly, let's speak a bit about Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
Okay.
So
the idea that we have about Imam Sajjad is the idea that this was we call him an Imam, but then the perception we have of him is a person who, after Ashura, is completely weakened, is always in his house, crying all the time. You know, this very feeble personality. And this again doesn't match with what we know of the Imam has to be Shuja. In fact, we even know the idea that Imam should stand for the truth, even go and fight the oppressor, right?
Yeah.
So how is it that there is an oppressor doing his oppression and ugly things happen, right? The whole attack on Medina, for example, that was a really bad event. And Imam Sajjad is just sitting there quietly, not getting involved in this. Now, how does this personality and how does this Imam Sajjad match with that brave Imam who is Ismail, who fights the oppressor that we've established intellectually?
When it comes to Imam Sajjad, we see first and foremost, lots of dynamics have changed. Two most important dynamics right now are that Imam Sajjad hasn't been asked for allegiance by the same individual who fought Imam Hussein alayhi salam for allegiance, right? So Imam Sajjad hasn't been asked for allegiance. So it's not like Imam Sajjad is put in this situation where he has to pay allegiance or rise, for example, right? Okay, so this is one instance, one circumstance, okay? One other change is the fact that, I can add two more changes, okay? Imam Sajjad again is left without companions, okay? After Ashura, companions, the likes that Amirul Mu'mineen had when he became caliph, at least 10, 15 of them, 20 of them, or the companions, the sort that Abu Abdullah alayhi salam had, Imam Sajjad lacks such companions, right? Again, in another tradition, again, it says about Imam Sajjad alayhi salam that irtadda an-nas ba'da al-Husayn alayhi salam illa thalatha, Abu Khalid al-Kabuli wa Yahya bin Umm al-Tawil wa Jubair bin Mut'im. Okay, so there's three individuals who are really these close companions of Imam Sajjad. But otherwise, Imam Sajjad, basically, he's left without any infrastructure. He doesn't have people to work with. So now he's not in a situation to rise and claim power or, for example, fight an oppressor, lead a revolution. He's not in such a position. Okay, he's
just
alone.
Just to clarify this hadith, irtada nas, irtada means to become to leave religion. Can you just elaborate?
In this context, in all these traditions, it means that they left a certain extent of the truth. Okay, so they left the truth of wilayah either completely, or they fell in doubt about the imam, or they weren't in a position where they were ready to sacrifice their lives and belongings and position for Islam, basically. So they weren't at that highest level of iman where the imam needed him, or imam would need them to be able to carry out his responsibilities.
Okay.
So in other words, If
turning their back away from
it
Imam.
It is very similar to idea that we have with regards to Ghaibah, right? When the people aren't ready, okay, with all the different reasons that we have for Ghaibah, when the people aren't ready, the Imam isn't available. One reason being the Imam, who is he to lead? Who is he to lead and march forward to set a system, for example, right? There is no one, right? Mm-hmm. Imam is not going to come and commit suicide.
We said there is both sides, right? The Imam wants to do his responsibility, but he needs the platform for it. He needs the help to do that. The Ansarullah, the Ansar of the Imam have to help him.
So Imam Sajjad is in such a position, right? So he needs to now, putting all these together, what he needs to do is he needs to start working on training individuals. Okay. Now, one advantage that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has is the incident of Ashura, right? Now, this incident of Ashura, we know that in the future, at least, maybe not directly right after after Ashura, but in the years to come until today, it has such an impact on Islam that is going to, you know, it's as though the blood of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam is boiling until today, right? And it's going to keep creating people to rise, fight oppression, lead revolutions, yeah, that people won't be able to sit calmly in the face of oppression, right? But this takes a while for it because the community has been shook, right? This is where Imam Sajjad comes in and he's like, look, what I need to do is I need to start working from scratch, like the Prophet. Mm. Okay, I'm in such a situation where I don't have anyone. Mm. Yeah, I need to start from scratch. He takes the incident of Ashura as one of his tools or one of his weapons. Okay, and he says, I need to build on this. I need to make this so important. I need to make this so important that this shouldn't die.
Yeah. And just to clarify, it is important. I need to bring its importance
to
the people.
I need to make it, like, people need to keep remembering it. Yeah, inna dhikra tanfa'ul mu'mineen, or this remembrance is so important for people to keep remembering it again and again and again until it becomes so important they start questioning what really happened.
Start to realize that, you know,
what happened
going
in Ashura?
On,
yeah. Who was Abu Abdullah? Was he a normal individual? He was the grandson of the Prophet. Why did this happen? Who was Yazid? What was Imam Hussein really standing for? What were his principles, right? So this is where now Imam Sajjad has to work with individuals, or, like, you know, in a way that he's not going out and brandishing a sword or telling people to join him. What he's going to do is he's going to try and teach people who are not ready to listen to him, right? They don't accept him. So he has to go out in the public basically and spread this message. And this is why we keep hearing constantly that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam did two things. One, he kept remembering and reminding people of Ashura. And two were the du'as. Now, very quickly, what were these du'as? These du'as were packets of knowledge in the purest of forms. Now, Imam Sajjad does not have this opportunity to come and speak to people and tell them, let's sit down, let's have classes, let me teach you a hadith, let me teach you fiqh. They don't accept in the i'tiqadat of the they don't believe in the beliefs of the Shias, right? Okay? So Imam Sajjad is forced to start from scratch. These du'as, that's why I have two very strong messages in them. The concept of Tawheed, definitely, because if you don't understand Tawheed, you can't build on your beliefs, right? So Imam is again talking about Tawheed and understand the essence of Tawheed. What is the reality of Tawheed? What are the responsibilities that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects from you, right? This is one, okay? And the concept of Wilaya, again, is a message that's within these du'as. We ourselves sometimes fail to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dua number one of Sahifa Sajjadiyya. Walhamdulillah alladhi ikhtar lana mahasin al-khalq wa ajra alayna tayyibat al-rizq wa ja'ala lana al-fadilata bil-malakati ala jami' al-khalq fa kullu khaliqatihi munqadatun lana biqudratihi. Praise belongs to Allah, who chose for us good qualities of creation, appointed for us excellence through domination over all creation, and every one of his creatures submits to us through his power.
Is he talking about us as human beings?
It seems he's speaking about Wilayat Takwini. Okay, that all existences submit to the Imam and they serve the Imam. Right? So he's speaking about, but again, in words that can be difficult to understand, can be difficult for the people to understand. So people, when they listen to this, they might, you know, like, it can pass easily, right? Because Imam is not in a position to come and say openly that, okay, we have these status, for example, in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? But again, there are places where, now look at this, dua of Arafah. So he's on the plains of Arafah, okay, dua number 47. رب صل على أطائب أهل بيته الذين اخترتهم لأمرك وجعلتهم خزنة علمك وحفظة دينك. Again, the same concepts that we've been speaking about. My Lord, bless the best of his household, those whom thou hast chosen for thy command, appointed the treasures of thy knowledge, the guardians of thy religion. وخلفائك في أرضك وحججك على عبادك. So again, he's speaking about the realities that, look, yes, Tawheed in its place, but you guys have forgotten the concept of Imam. Yeah, you guys have forgotten the concept of Wilaya. And this is why what's happened with the Muslim Ummah, right? And now he's reminding the people that, look, this is, there's a special position of the Ahlul Bayt, and until you do not submit to him, yeah, you will stay in this darkness.
So it's very interesting that this this image we have of Imam Sajjad is a very wrong image, that he, you know, he's weak and he can't do anything, and he's sort of you know, shocked by Ashura. It sort of seems like that, you know, he's shocked by Ashura. Whereas
in fact, it's a very wrong understanding. Yeah. A masum imam cannot be such that he is only driven by emotions.
Yeah.
And I mean, what he is the epitome of someone who carries out his responsibility.
Exactly. So in history, the way this showed itself was because of the pressure, and apparently there was so much spying happening on him and so much pressure, and he was not accepted by the society, at least from at a general level, right? So he had to sort of start a way, like you really well said, that it's as if you have to start from scratch all over again, you know, all the effort being
so
made.
So he's laying these foundations for people to slowly understand, okay, like what is true Islam.
Yeah, but he's stepping on that big impact that Imam Hussein made in Ashura. That's really important, that Imam Sajjad is using or continuing the message of Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein made the big bang. Now Imam Sajjad needs to use this and bring it to the people. Obviously, that emotional side needs to be stronger, right? Because Ashura has a very strong emotional side to it, which is what brings back life. Exactly. Yeah. This is supposed to bring life to the people. And so Imam Sajjad, through these methods, through his dua, so we know him as an abid, you know, Sayyidu Sajidin, not because, you know, he didn't care about society, because this is how, through these duas, he was giving the ma'arif of the Ahlul Bayt. And again, we don't read these duas, so we don't really know about this, right? We need to really read these duas, sometimes read it not as a communication with Allah, but just open it and to learn things from it, right?
Yeah. So now, quickly again, moving forward, what's happened now is Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is working again on the beliefs, on the realities, the teachings, these lofty beliefs of Islam, right? When you come to Imam Bakr and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam's time, that's where now slowly, because of the political strife, because of the situation, they start getting some freedom, right? Again, Imam Sajjad's time, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with the Umayyads in power in the countries that are in their territory, okay? And we are looking at, in Makkah, Abdullah bin Zubair. And Abdullah bin Zubair, who's renowned for his enmity and his hatred for Bani Hashim, right? So Imam Sajjad is in the midst of this. There's only so much that he can do, right? Yeah. So he's, and again, we said there's no people, he doesn't have support. He's working with people at this very ground level, right? When Imam Bakr and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in their period, this political difficulty eases up a bit, right? But now again, what is the situation of the Shias? Yeah, again, we sometimes wonder why don't we have, for example, books from the time of the earlier Imams? That's where the doubt comes in, right? That all these beliefs have been made in, for example, the 3rd century, 4th century. If you look at all the situation that the Imams were in, we realize that there was no room for doing more than this. The Imams were working at their maximum capacity. Effort and maximum capacity. Okay, Al-Kafi, in a very strong hadith with a very good chain, says that the Shias were in a form of absolute cultural poverty. Culture in the sense they didn't have knowledge of their basic halal and haram. Okay, they didn't have scholars, they didn't have books. And then when Imam Bakr,
the main scholars were destroyed, right? They were killed. Yeah. Imam Hassan's time, Imam Hussein's time.
Yeah. So now, apart from the few companions that slowly Imam Sajjad has been able to work on, the Shia still haven't come out of this. You know, they're still trying to gain their identity.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's not like even the communities are not clear. It's not like the Shias have their own community and they, you know, they're set apart and distant from the other communities. No, they're living within the same people. Yeah, this tradition, it says, so the narrator asks Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who are the Imams that we need to believe in, right? And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is mentioning all the Imams. So he says, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, and then he goes on. Then he says, ثُمَّ كَانَ مُحَمَّدْ بِنْ عَلِي أَبَا جَعْفَرْ وكانت الشيعة قبل أن يكون أبو جعفر وهم لا يعرفون مناسك حجهم وحلالهم وحرامهم. So the Shias, until Imam Bakr alayhi salam became the Imam, the Shias didn't know their manasik of Hajj, they didn't know their halal and haram. This was the poverty the Shias were living in. right? Distance from the imams, looking at Imam Sajjad after Ashura, these Shias now slowly they've started understanding the role of the imam, the position of the imam, right? Now this is where the imams need to come and work on the fiqh, okay, and the give Shia its identity, right? And this is what the tradition says, that حَتَّى كَانَ أَبُو جَعْفَرْ فَفَتَّحَ لَهُمْ. When Imam Bakr alayhi salam came, he opened up these doors of knowledge for them. Okay, وَبَيَّنَ لَهُمْ مَنَاسِكَ حَجِّهِمْ وَحَلَالَهُمْ وَحَرَامَهُمْ. He taught them the teachings of Islam and the fiqh, the principles of the teachings of Islam. Okay, حَتَّى صَارَ النَّاسُ يَحْتَاجُونَ إِلَيْهِمْ مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا كَانُوا يَحْتَاجُونَ إِلَى النَّاسِ. So until before Imam Bakr alayhi salam, the Shias were dependent on the other communities, the other schools of thought. Okay, and after Imam Bakr alayhi salam, the Shias became so strong in terms of knowledge, obviously, that now the sarannasu yahtajuna ilayhim, that the other people now felt the need of not going to the imam, going to the Shias. So this is the massive difference that Imam Bakr and Imam Sadiq were able to bring about. And that's where we spoke in the previous session, right? We spoke about how they trained the companions, yeah, and then how these companions themselves reached a point by the time of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam that they would say that fuqihna fi din, we've become faqih, we understand the religion, every question that comes up, we know what the ruling is.
Again, this is such an important impact and so necessary at the time. It sort of also answers this doubt that sometimes comes, that why didn't the imams make the most of that quarrel between the Umayyads and Abbasids to also do a revolt and take over the power, right?
So now this is the interesting point, right? Okay, so the imams, we said, have responsibilities, okay? Again, just to bold this idea of responsibility, okay, there's a very interesting hadith, okay? And then I'll come back to the point I was trying to make, okay? So in this tradition, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in Al-Kafi with a very good chain, okay, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that if it wasn't for these oppressors, I wish that I would have been able to take you people in an empty land, in a deserted area, okay, where I'm with you alone. I have a qasr, a sort of fortress, okay, where I can work with you, I can train you, I can turn you into scholars. Yeah, and in a way that these oppressors do not come and harm you, your lives are not endangered. So this is the, again, why am I saying this? This is that sort of ultimate aim that the imam has in mind, that look, I need to have a safe haven for my people, for the Shias, those who believe in the wilaya, okay? And then work with them, help them reach, like help them in their servitude. This is what the imam is here for, right? Yeah, why did the Prophet migrate to Medina? Again, to have his own establishment where now he can work with the people and take them to perfection. Yeah.
As we said, that the tarbiyah of the people, the protection of deen, the explanation of deen, all of it requires that security, and that security comes in establishment.
Yeah. So now this comes with a different forms, right? It comes with this leadership, it comes with intellectual leadership, academic leadership, comes with political leadership, yeah? So now, this point that you mentioned, that why did the imams not rise and make use of this political instability, right? Again, put the two together, that the imam wants to rise, okay? The imam wants to rise when there's an opportunity. On the other hand, he needs to work with the Shias as well, right? This is that time where the imam is really now giving out the real teachings of Islam. Mm. So this is really crucial, that if there's it's a hit and a miss. If you miss and you lose, then again, all this training and all the training and the efforts of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, Ashura first of all, okay, and all the previous imams for that matter, but Ashura, and then Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, all the training that he did, and then Imam Bakr, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, all this goes in vain because you led a revolution and it failed, right? So he has to be very careful. Now, when you look at the traditions, you see both sorts of traditions. There are traditions where individuals come to the imams and say that, okay, this individual is rising. You know, the Abbasids started rising, right? The Banu al-Abbas, Abu al-Abbas Safwan and Mansur. These people rose against the Umayyads. Okay, and then you had other revolutions as well, right? These individuals who were sort of influenced by Ashura, and then they'd become they'd become fiery, and now they would want to fight the systems, right? So in many instances, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam would, and Imam Bakr and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam would discourage the companions from rising. Okay, so sometimes when you see traditions like these, you feel like, okay, wait, you're absolutely, the Imam has forbidden you from rising at all points. We have to wait until the reappearance of Imam Zaman, right? On the other hand, we have traditions where constantly, okay, the imam is reminding the companions that, for example, the companions would come to the imam and ask them, who is the qa'im? Okay, and the imams would say that, kulluna qa'im. Hmm. So we have a whole section in Al-Kafi where the imam is mentioning these traditions where, kulluna qa'im. And the imam says, who is the al-mahdi? And the imam says, kulluna nahdi, all of us guide. Right, and then the guy says, who is the sahibu saif? And the imam says, kulluna sahibu saif.
Sahibu saif meaning the one who
has the sword. Yeah. Okay, again, in other traditions, we have where the imams, so we have a whole section again, babu man indahum min salahi rasulillah. The section of dealing with the traditions about the imams being the individuals who have the weapons of the Holy Prophet. Okay, and again, the individuals would come to the imam and say, like, what are the signs that you are the imam? Obviously, the imam can speak about miracles. He can show his ilmul ghaib. One of the things that the imams would use would be the weapons, the sword and the armor of the Holy Prophet. And then they would bring out this concept. They would say that we're waiting for the right time to rise. Mm. Okay, we're waiting for the sign. We're waiting for the people to be ready. We're waiting for the sign from Allah Subhanahu wa Taala to rise. Yeah. So now putting these together, you realize that look, the imam did want to lead a revolution. Okay. Again, we said that, right? He wanted the Shias to have a place where the Shias can carry out their responsibilities, where they can be under the guidance of the imam of the time and reach perfection. And build that ideal society. Yeah.
And also to bring guidance to the whole of the Ummah.
After that, yes, be able to spread the message to the whole world, right? So the imam has this aim in mind. At the same time, he has to look at the situation. Right now, looking at the situation, if he sees that the Shias are not ready, again, the imam, it's for the imam to realize, right? Again, we have the traditions where individuals would come to the imam would say, we don't have sufficient companions to rise. Mm-hmm. If we had, we would have, right? So the imam is looking at both these together, and then he's deciding that, look, right now is not the ideal time. So for now, I'll keep focusing this in the apparent. I'll keep focusing on training the students, okay? If the opportunity comes up, then we'll rise.
Mm-hmm. So can I also add this to the fact that when Imam Sadiq did not rise, and we could easily say that, look, why are you giving the possibility that they would fail? The Banu Abbas was strong, they were looking for a leader, and they were happy to take Imam Sadiq as a leader. We can sort of mirror this back to Imam Ali when the people rushed to him and said, please be our caliph. Imam Ali said no, because he knew that these people are not coming to me for the right reason. And later on in history, when we wait a bit, we realize that these Bani Abbas who came to Imam Sadiq to lead their revolution, they were not good people.
Yeah, in fact.
So for Imam Sadiq to accept, just because he wants to come into power, he accepts the help of evil people. Imam wasn't ready to do that. If Imam takes a political role, he would want to do it with the right people.
Exactly. And it's clear, eventually in history, we know that the Abbasids decided with the Bani al-Hasan, the descendants of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And then Imam Sadiq tries to prevent it from happening as well. He tries to discourage his cousins, his relatives. It doesn't work out. They think that the Imam doesn't want them to gain power. Mm. And then eventually the Bani al-Abbas backtrack and they fall apart, basically. Mm.
Unfortunately, again, we put other things aside. Maybe the wrong understanding of the deen, because we have this concept that the Imam is the one who is the qa'im, who rises with the sword at all costs, right?
Yeah.
And this is a wrong understanding of the deen, right? The imam does what needs to be done. Yeah, if rising is the right thing to be done, they'll do it. And Imam Hussein did it.
This is key at all times. We need to understand, we need to keep looking at what the imam is doing. Follow him. Where we don't understand, we bounce it off the principles.
Yeah.
We take it forward to the imam. We ask him why he's doing what he's doing, why he's not
doing
what he's
doing. And this is the key to Isma, right? This is why we said one of the key characteristics of the Imam is Isma, that we should know that whatever he's saying is true. We submit to it without questioning. If Imams did not have Isma, then there would be room to question Imam. Oh, Imam, why are you saying this? I don't agree with you. But you can't do that because you know whatever he says is completely in line with what Allah says. And this is where all this sums up, that you have to submit to the Imam. If you take the Imam as a normal scholar who's pious like any other pious scholar, then there's room for disagreement, right? And their imamate doesn't work out. Their role of guiding doesn't work out because people can agree to disagree, basically.
Definitely.
Which doesn't work again. So this idea of Isma again shows itself in history. Mm-hmm. But there's a really important question regarding Imam Sadiq. And that is that, now we know that there was a fight between Bani Umayyah and Bani al-Abbas, and that's why Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq managed to train so many scholars and spread the real deen of Islam. why were they doing taqiyya then? Because we know that Imam Sadiq, we know there's many ahadith that we say that, oh, put this aside, it was in taqiyya. Put that aside, it was, as if it's become like a card you pull out whenever things don't make sense to us. So was there taqiyya in Imam Sadiq's time? Why would Imams do taqiyya again? How does taqiyya match with shuja'ah, this idea of being brave?
It's a very good question, and again, yeah, it keeps coming up again. Like, why was the Imam doing taqiyya? Let's understand what taqiyya is quickly. Some scholars, okay, so there's different definitions of taqiyya. Sheikh Mufid has his definition. Some scholars have offered their definitions. Okay, for example, one definition is kitmanul haq, hiding the truth. Okay, Sheikh Ansari has a very interesting definition. He says, "Taqiyya huwa tahaffuz an darar al ghair." So it's protecting yourself from the harm of someone else by agreeing with him in his word or his action, even though it's against the truth. Okay? So taqiyya is not just saying something that's not the truth or hiding something. Taqiyya can be at a much broader level, can be defined as taking a stance that is not in line with the primary responsibility. Okay, so the initial responsibility that would have been your responsibility in normal circumstances, carrying out a stance, okay, which is against that in order to protect. Now, what are you talking about? What protection? Okay. When I'm looking at myself, okay, taqiyya at my individual level, I might be doing taqiyya to protect my life, okay? There's one time I'm doing taqiyya to protect my family, okay? There's one time the Imam does taqiyya to protect the religion, to protect his people, okay? So taqiyya can be seen at different levels. There's a taqiyya at an individual level, there's a taqiyya at a social level, right? Now, the taqiyya that we're talking about, okay, with regards to the Imams, are of different levels and different degrees. Okay, yes, there are instances where, for example, because of the situation that the Imam is in, the Imam cannot come and give an individual the right fiqh ruling. Think of Ali bin Yaqtin, right? Ali bin Yaqtin is working in the court of one of the caliphs, okay, and he asks the Imam on how to do wudu, right? The Imam gives him the Ahlus Sunnah version of performing wudu because he knows that, look, this guy is working in the court, okay? Someone's going to snitch on him, okay? And if people see that he's doing wudu in our way, he's going to be in trouble, okay? He's my man, I want to defend his life, and he's doing so much, he's my representative, right? Okay? He's helping the Shias because of his position, right? I want to save his life. Now, for saving his life, Imam gives him a different ruling. You can call it the wrong ruling. It's a different ruling. Now, this is taqiyya. There's one time at the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam where he's not carrying out certain responsibilities. And I mean, you know, like, for example, in this discussion that we had about rising, okay, the Imam's responsibility, let's say, is to rise, okay? The Imam sees it not a good move, okay? Now, it doesn't make sense for the Imam to go around telling people that, look, I want to rise, but I'm not going to rise because it's not a good move, right? What is he going to do? He's going to hide this reality from the people, right? He's going to hide it from his own people. Okay, it's not like he's going to tell the people and say, don't tell the other people, right? He's going to hide it from his own people, okay? Just so that these people don't go start talking about this, right? Is he going to hide it from everyone? No, some of his companions were much closer to him, okay? They are like the likes of Zurara, for example. We spoke about these companions, right?
Companions to whom they share their secrets, basically.
Yeah, okay. There are companions who are really close to Imam. The Imam trusts them. The Imam knows that these guys, they know how to behave. They know where to say, right? Okay, so the Imam will tell them these secrets. Okay, the Imam will tell them, for example, that, look, we want to rise. Okay, right now is not the right time. When some other individual will come and he'll tell Imam that we want to rise, we're ready for rising, for example, the Imam will tell him that, no, we don't want to rise. Like, no, we're waiting for Imam Zaman, for example. Like, or any community that rises before the Qiyam of Imam Zaman is bound to defeat. Yeah. Now, the Imam will say this because he doesn't want to get this an individual into this idea that, oh, look, we want to rise, but we're not right now, it's not the right time, because this person will go and speak to someone else, he'll speak to someone else, and so on and so forth. So now, when you put these traditions together, what has reached us is without these historic details. We just know that there are two traditions out there from Imam Sadiq. One says rise, one says not to rise. Right? One says do wudu in this manner, one says do wudu in this manner. This is where this taqiyya card that you're saying comes out. Obviously, we try and reconcile traditions.
If we go into history, then we find that actually. Can we sum up a taqiyya in what you mentioned in one of your previous session? Don't say what you don't know, but don't say everything that you know. Don't say everything that you know. There are certain things that don't need to be said.
It's a strategic move. The imam, and we need to learn this as well. We need to know what to say when.
Yeah.
Right. We do not come and say everything in every circumstance. Right. And again, this is so intellectually, it's so obvious. Okay, this principle of taqiyya is so obvious. Yes, there might be some integrity details, keeping those aside. This concept is so obvious and so rational. We've had this throughout history, right? Now, for example, very quickly, the whole story of the individual Abu Lubaba who went and he revealed a secret to the Jews, and the Prophet was not happy with him, and this person was sort of banished, or he realized he had made a mistake, and then he had to seek forgiveness from the Prophet. And okay, that whole story, what really happened? He revealed the secret. He was supposed to hide it. He revealed the secret, right?
He said something he shouldn't have said, which is basically what taqiyya is about.
So we have instances like these throughout where something shouldn't have happened, but someone went and said something. Or for example, the Prophet hid something. Right, so we have instances like these. These are all forms of taqiyya, where a strategic move is happening. Now, sometimes it happens at a social level. Sometimes it happens at a governing level. Sometimes, it's at a personal level.
But then the question is, okay, why Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq? We understand why Imam Sajjad should have done taqiyya. We can understand why the later Imams had to do taqiyya. But Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq were living in an open time.
It's not that open, really. Again, it's not that open, right? First of all, again, if you look at historically, look at the caliphs that have passed at the time of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Okay, it's toward the end of the time of Imam Baqir alayhi salam where he has gained some. In fact, not even the end, maybe somewhere in between, because in the end he's martyred by the Umayyad caliph. The time connected to Imam Sajjad, again, there's pressure. Okay, so there's a time in between where things ease up for him and he's in a position to speak more freely, okay, in his own circle of companions, right? Again, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, so many caliphs have passed in this period, okay? There are times when Imam is not in a position to speak openly, okay? So during the period of the Umayyads and during the periods of the Abbasids, again, he's not in a position to speak openly. There's one period in between where the Imam has this freedom. Again, this freedom in certain regards. Don't forget, we had the discussion on hulu. We had the discussion, we mentioned that there were multiple circles that were popping out of nowhere, right? There were at least, if you just look at Rijal Kashi, for example, or some of the other books as well, you see 14, all these 15. Different sects that are coming out. There's the, in the Ahlus Sunnah, there's different sects of beliefs, okay? Then there's different political ideologies that are coming out. All these different imam has to...
I guess also the Shias in the minority. So from the start, whilst he's trying to build them and strengthen them, it's not the right time to say again everything that needs to be said. There's certain things that need to be kept to go slowly, basically, right? In a gradual way. So in the start, for example, they don't have to reveal everything.
All the teachings of Islam don't need to come in at the same time. The Shias are constantly learning.
Yeah. I guess just to wrap this up, one of the other, actually when you think about it again, one of the other indications that the time was not so open is that actually Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq were actually killed by the Khulafa, or they were killed at least, right? Which shows that they were not so open either. There was some restrictions on them. And this again shows that the necessity for taqiyya was there, and they had to be careful in what they say, how they say it, especially when it came to social political matters, especially when it came to, I guess, being the minority, matters that are sensitive between Shia and Sunni, right? They don't want to create a rift between these two. So coming up with ahkam that really contradict each other would be a big blow at that time, right? Especially the Shias are new, they're growing. So again, they have to take care of all these different dynamics.
I think it's just the key point over here is that maybe we have this misunderstanding that there is an age of taqiyya and then there's not an age of taqiyya. It's not like that, really. These are situations. I mean, an hour ago might be a period of taqiyya and an hour later might not be a period of taqiyya. Yeah. Or even, for example, there's two people in two different rooms. The imam might speak with taqiyya with one of them and the imam might speak without taqiyya with one of them. So these are instances. Yeah.
In fact, this reminds me of a hadith I was reading the other day where this scholar was analyzing one of the people around Imam Sadiq, and he shows a few hadiths to show that Imam Sadiq, at the presence of this guy, was cautious because he was suspicious that this might be a spy. So Imam Sadiq in sittings where that person would be there would be very careful of the things he says. Sometimes he would say things in a very unclear way so that this person does not get something out to report back about Imam against
even,
Imam.
More than this, like we mentioned, right? The idea that there's levels of companions. So there's even instances where the Imam says a reality to one companion and then another companion comes in and tells him a higher reality, right? Or he interprets the words differently, words of the Quran differently. Again, because that companion has the capacity of understanding that reality, whether it's a reality or whether accepting that secret. The companion, the first companion, for example, is not in a position to understand it or accept it. Or if he does, he'll go and reveal it outside, whereas Imam does not want it to be revealed. So again, this is a form of taqiyya, where Imam wants this secret to be hidden. So he doesn't go around telling everyone about it, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So because we're very short on time, should we fast forward to Imam Mahdi?
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. So very quickly, just in the fast forward. So now what if the Imams, one of their major successes was instilling the idea of referring to the scholars, to the companions, to these close companions, to the extent that the Imams themselves would introduce these companions to the people, right? So now this is one of those ideas that carried on to the extent that it became a whole network of representatives. The Imams had their contacts in different cities. These contacts would be the representative, would carry out the different responsibilities and the tasks ordained by the Imam in their communities, right? And these would be known individuals. The people would know that, okay, this person, he is the contact of the Imam, to the point where we reach Sahab al-Zaman, right? So just before Sahab al-Zaman, Imam Hasan al-Askari, when you're looking at the time, again, from the time of Imam Ridha's Shahada, okay, so somewhere between 200 to 205, like 203, 204 Hijra, all the way until 250, 259, right, 260, right? After Imam Ridha alayhi salam, Imam Jawad alayhi salam, Imam Hadi alayhi salam, and then Imam Hasan Askari alayhi salam. So three Imams have passed in this short period, have been martyred. Just goes on to show like how this oppression again, is increasing. Okay, it's increasing. The Imams are more often in prison than outside, right? They're in prison in prisons where are unknown to people, right? For example, in Samarra, for example.
Yeah. Like Sheikh Ali mentioned, itself is a sort of ghaiba in that sense.
Yeah. So where the Imams
cut off from their community.
Yeah, the Imams have already planned for this. And the idea of referring to the scholars is increasing. Again, the scholars have been trained, okay? Where the scholars need now, they write to the Imam. This is where the whole... we have instances where the companions would dress up as vegetable sellers, cucumber sellers, and try and get to the Imam if the Imam's in house arrest, for example, in the form of a grocer, come to the Imam and pass messages, right, and leave. So this is the situation that we're looking at. Okay. It comes to a point where Imam Zaman alayhi salam is born. He's not even announced. Normally, if you look at the traditions and the Sunnah of the Imams, when the Imam would be born, when an Imam would be born, when a child would be born in the household of the Ahlul Bayt, they would, make a big deal about it. They would mention, their companions would be called, it would be announced openly. But with regards to Imam Zaman, nothing is mentioned, to the extent that only the close companions, the aunt of Imam Hasan al-Askari, Bibi Hakima, she is aware of the birth, and some very close companions are aware of the birth of Imam Zaman. Mm. So it's kept a complete secret. Now, how are we aware of this? Because of the traditions from these individuals who've met the Imams, right?
No, in fact, one of the ways, so like we said, we established that we can form our beliefs from what the Prophet has said, from the Quran and so on. So here we have prophetic narrations of the 12 Khalifs.
Oh, yeah.
And then we have that intellectual backing.
We know that the 12th Imam has to be there, right?
Yeah, so it strengthens our understanding.
The historic aspect of the Imam being born, he kept in secret. These are what the historic evidence tells us, right?
So sort of, it's like sort of explaining that, okay, we believe in 12 Imams, but why was this such a secret? What's, we don't know much about the 12 Imams. There isn't like a widespread knowledge of the Imams
because again,
anymore.
Because of this situation. With this pressure, now if the Imams are being assassinated, and as I was going to make this point later, but one of the results that happened after Imam Zaman went into occultation, one of the things that started happening was the governing system started refuting the idea that, no, there was an Imam, that something really happened, right? They made it clear that, okay, we were watching over Imam Hassan al-Askari's house. We know that there was no child over there, right? So the Imam is aware that, like, this is the situation. If the governing, the caliphate comes to know that there's a son in the house, there's a child born, they're going to come after him. They want to kill him.
In fact, they know these ahadith. Like we've said earlier, these ahadith of 12 caliphs was there amongst Ahl Sunnah as well. It's something that's there in the Ummah, not just amongst the Shias.
The Shias books are being transmitted between the people, right? So there is this sort of, I mean, at least we can speculate and come to a guess that, yes, maybe the governors and the caliphs were strictly worried about this, that if Askari has a son, then he is going to be the 12th.
Yeah, there's so many qiyams going on across this time of the Bani Abbas that if the Shias gather around this one person that they strongly believe is a qaim, this is the end of the government, basically.
So again, I think you've already spoken about this, the traditions that we have and the meetings that were there with the Imam. Just very interesting tradition, again, from Sheikh Saduq. One of the companions, Ahmad bin Ishaq al-Ashari, good companion, he comes to Imam Zaman and he comes to Imam Hassan al-Askari, okay? And in fact, he's asking Imam Hassan al-Askari about Imam's successor, okay? So the Imam tells him, the Imam first tells him that, why are you asking? And, so he tells the Imam that we know that there's an Imam, right? Like, we know that there's an Imam at all times, okay? The earth is never going to be void of an Imam. Who's the Imam after you? Okay, and then the Imam goes to his room and he says, لَوْلَا كَرَامَتُكَ عَلَى اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ وَعَلَى حُجَجِهِ مَا أَرَضَتُ عَلَيْكَ إِبْنِ هَذَا. So if it wasn't for your station with us, okay, I wouldn't have showed the Imam to you. And then he goes and then he brings Imam out in his hands. He's carrying Imam Zaman and he shows him to Ahmad bin Ishaq al-Ashari. So he's making it clear that, look, this is a secret. I'm not revealing it to everyone. Okay, you're a close companion. I'm letting you know. Again, this was important. Again, the question might come, the why tell some and why not tell the others, right? Again, we mentioned one point was that there were differences in the companions, right? And so it's important tomorrow when Imam does go into occultation, it's important that there are proofs, there are evidence that the Imam was born.
Reliable people have witnessed
These individuals are that sort of, they're the link, that they come and say, yes, we have witnessed the Imam, we've already seen him. Right? And these are notable companions of the Imam. They're known for their piety. When they come and speak out, the people will accept their word. Right? At the same time, so Imam Zaman goes into Ghaiba in 260, 259, 260. Okay? 270, 280 onwards, books are being written about Ghaiba now. Until now, the idea of Imamah had existed. The idea of Ghaiba had also existed. We have traditions about the last one going into this occultation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay? But maybe we didn't have independent and...
collections, basically.
Independent books, like one specific manual speaking about the Imam Zaman only, right? Mm-hmm. Now that the scholars started facing the situation, okay, the people obviously are in a situation where they understand that there is an Imam, okay?
Well, there should be an Imam, yeah. but they just don't have any signs of it. They haven't seen him.
So naturally, there's this confusion, okay, to some extent at least,
yeah,
okay, that we haven't seen the Imam, okay, alhamdulillah, their companions who are telling us that they've seen the Imam. Now bear in mind this as well, right? Imam Hassan al-Askari was in Samarra, okay,
quite far from that center,
yeah,
of the Shia.
It's like a 12 or 7-hour drive from Baghdad, I believe. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the scholars, the Shia community is mainly settled in Baghdad and largely in Qom, okay, and obviously other places, but these are the two centers, right? So now for news to reach these places at least, right? And then events that started happening afterwards, yeah? There are individuals that started claiming Imamah for themselves. Yeah. This is the same period, pretty much the same period where, if I'm not mistaken, yes, this is pretty much the same period where the Fatimid Empire rises in the name of Imam Mahdi as well. Mm. So there are different instances, there are different issues that are happening at the same time, right? Now the scholars, this is where their role like their focus turns into writing about Mahdawiya, right? So we have an extremely important scholar, Abdullah bin Ja'far al-Himyari, okay, extremely important scholar of Qom. He writes at least three books on Ghaiba. He moves from Qom to Kufa to start teaching. Now, Kufa is not the center of knowledge anymore. So he moves from Qom to Kufa and he becomes a teacher over there and he starts guiding the people. Father of Sheikh Saduq again has a manual on Ghaiba. Sheikh Kulaini has written about Ghaiba in his Al-Kafi. Sheikh Saduq again writes about Al-Ghaiba. He has a few manuals. Imam Zaman comes in his dream according to what he has said. Yeah, and we believe in him. We accept him as a truthful, honest, thiqa, trustworthy individual. He says that Imam Zaman came in his dream and told him how to write his book. Okay. So Sheikh Saduq writes his book on Ghaiba, and then Nu'mani, Sheikh Tusi, Sheikh Mufid, all these scholars start writing on Ghaiba to start educating the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, these scholars, that this goes on to show that these scholars were ready for this, right?
So obviously there would be a sort of a question on one side. There would be questions in the minds of the people that look, Imam Askari was what, 25 when he was martyred, right? So very young imam. His son, like, where is his son? We haven't heard of him.
People are belying as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a strong agenda that's pushing that, no, he didn't have a son. And he's quite young. So how old would his son be if he had a son?
And then another,
on this side, they also have this experience of having a young imam, right? It's the wisdom of Allah is amazing.
When you look at the evidence out there, it does seem that any of the issues that were there, at least in the start, were to do with accepting in the imam being young, for example, right? Or the existence of the 12th imam. Yeah. These weren't the questions.
Yeah, that happened in the time of Imam Jawad. Just the experience of having a young imam.
Officially Ghaiba that they've heard of so far. It was the first time it was really transpiring. So it was a new experiment in that sense, right? It was a new experience. Okay. Now this is where they needed a backing of the scholars to come and sort of.
I guess, like we said in the previous session, Ghaiba is very heavy, right? So even if it's a reality you accept, but it's hard to swallow. So you need that. Those arguments and reminders again from the Prophet, from the Imam Zaluk, this is something that was said before, you know, this is not something new, things, it's not gone out of plan, you know, this was bound to happen. This was the succession of the Imams and the way the people dealt with the Imams, this was bound to lead to this. Those reminders were important for the Shias to become firm in their in back in their beliefs, basically.
Yeah, definitely. And then I mean, after that it seems to ease up a bit. Obviously, problems remain. So there's these other movements that come into existence, right, in different parts of the world, as in the region. We also had some companions or some Shias, unfortunately, who even fought the or disregarded the representation, the Nawab of the Imams, right, of the four Nawab, right? So some of them would rise and not accept the representation of one of them, for example. So these skirmishes or these small issues would keep coming up. But at one point, it got to a point where, like, after Sheikh Kulaini, especially towards the end of Ghaibat Sohra, and then going into Sheikh Kulaini, Sheikh Saduq's time, and then the imparting of knowledge that they did, it came to a point where the people started now accepting that, okay, look, yes, we had been waiting for it, as in we had been informed about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, our forefathers had been told about it. Okay, we have traditions, we have all the arguments, we've understood it. This is the reality. It is a reality, and there's, I mean, like, we have to accept it. Like, yeah. Yeah, there's the, if we reject this, then all of religion goes under question, because we're rejecting the traditions that we have, all these books, all these narrators who until now were trustworthy. And then when it comes to Ghaiba, when they start speaking about the living imam, having seen the imam, the representation, the Nawab, Ghaibat Sughra, Ghaibat Kubra, all of this, if we're going to reject this, then it comes to a point where we might as well reject everything, right? And then slowly, that's how basically what we have today is a continuation of that, that the community slowly started accepting and, you know, like, submitting to this reality.
And it's a difficult reality, and it led to a lot of problems in terms of the knowledge, in terms of the imam not having that, you know, source of comfort to refer back to. And that's the imtihan, basically, of Ghaiba. And so, again, it really shows how what we proved and the Prophet having said certain things, when it actually happened, it's difficult to accept it. We know things intellectually, but when we look at things on ground, sometimes, like, this can't be, you know?
And this is, again, where the same verses come into play, right? And in fact, if you look at the traditions under these verses, you have references to the fact that even when it comes to the Imam Zaman, there will be this confusion. Mm-hmm. People will fail to accept. Even at the time of ghaiba, people will fail to accept the ghaiba of the Imam. Even when the Imam returns, the people will not, the same people who have waited for him will find it difficult to accept the same Imam. And the idea of test in the Quran, it's there, all out there. Yeah? That you can't just say that you believe in the Imam. You're going to face this test of wilaya yeah. at some point in time.
Yeah, and a beautiful hadith that Sheikh Imran had mentioned for us in his session, where he said that the hadith says that at the when you come to this time of ghaiba, you know, most of the people will say that, you know, they start doubting in the ghaiba, that maybe there is no such a thing as the Imam, and the Imam is warning us that, you know, this is going to happen. You're going to start having these doubts in your heart, because things sort of are becoming difficult now, right? Your Imam is not there, and ghaib is hard to believe in, right? That's why one of the conditions of a mu'min is to yu'minuna bil ghaib. And an Imam who is in ghaib, who is in ghaiba, is an Imam who is basically not visible to us, and it's hard to believe in that. So when he goes into ghaiba, now all of a sudden that those doubts sort of creep in. And Imam tells us that hold on to your religion, don't let go. People will doubt in this, and there are people every time, I guess, in every generation who will come and put doubts about Imam Mahdi. And we as believers have to be strong and keep going from. Asantum, so thank you very much. Very interesting discussion. Really helps to look at things from in perspective, you know, help bounce off those instances which are doubtful back to our foundations, what we have established, and put things into perspective. So really interesting. Jazakumullah, thank you so much, Sheikh Bakir. Brothers and sisters, inshallah, we'll wrap it up over here, and then we'll continue with the next session, inshallah, going into the next phase of our course, which is where we're going to be discussing ghaiba and the practical aspect of and our relationship with the Imam, and the whole idea of awaiting the Imam, and putting all of this knowledge that we have now into practice, so that we can help this information that's in our mind seep into our hearts and transform information into belief, inshallah. And this only comes when we put it into action. So inshallah, we'll start looking into all of this in the next session. So until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.